Welcome to this edition of This Is Design Intelligence, conversations with leadership voices in the built environment. This edition is sponsored by the Tricord Group, leading successful relationship constructs for over 25 years, and VIM, helping the architecture and design disciplines design, deliver, and operate better buildings for a better world.
Greetings, this is Dave Gilmore, and this is Design Intelligence. Today, I'm joined in the studio by Carl Giegold, the founding partner of Threshold Acoustics, operating out of Chicago. Today, we're going to have an intriguing conversation about acoustical engineering and the critical sense of hearing. Carl, thank you for joining me in the studio here today.
Thanks so much, Dave. It's a pleasure to chat.
What is going to happen, right? That's the big question. And we go, my gosh, we've been assaulted by this organic agent that's hit us, and that's caused us to reach up and pull the breakers off in the economy, and it's got us in this kind of strange place. But it's a different place than a traditional recessional cycle. It is something that we have really self-imposed in the name of health and public safety. And so now we're trying to figure out, what does that mean to the future? And I think about, what does it mean to the future of acoustical engineering when we see so many new expressions of how humans will gather? And essential to all that is our ability to experience the auditory value of an exchange with others, and how that can so often be diminished if not conceived on the front end of design. Some comments about that?
You know, I'd have to say that we look at this from a fairly primal or maybe primeval perspective, that, you know, humans evolved as social beings. The regions of the brain that support social interactions are particularly developed in humans, and it is, you know, partly their ability to act as groups in cooperation with each other, sometimes very large groups, that, you know, was certainly a factor in their commanding presence in the world, certainly influential presence in the world today, in the natural world and the built one. And so I feel like the impetus to gather is greater than any virus, and that we have proved time and time again, after plague after plague after plague over the course of history, that we're every bit as driven to gather tightly together afterwards as we were before. And I perhaps am short-sighted, but I don't see human nature as an instinct, and, you know, our evolutionary apparatus to have changed so much that isn't going to happen again.
We think about sound in the context of proximity, right? We think about people being together and the challenges that we now have and will have probably for the next year or two in this place. And as you say, we will go back to a place where we are by and large gathered together again. But we have this interim period where fear abounds around us coming together. Do we shift in any of our design work around acoustical engineering in this time, or do we stay the course, I guess is the question. If this is temporary, albeit a year or two, does it require something different from us?
I think it does, and it's a matter of what arithmetic, geometry, physics, that says the physical distances between us grow, the experience will change. Sound moves at a fixed speed, and time and distance are directly related to each other. The farther sound has to travel, the longer it takes to get there. Light moves instantaneously, and for all practical purposes, electricity does as well. But sound takes its time. And capturing as much of the essence of proximity as possible when we're all 6 feet from each other, you know, I think demands a different architectural response. And the question, I guess, is, you know, how we deal with that in spaces that may or may not become permanent. You know, understanding how a large lecture hall built for 300 people works for 30 is, you know, we hope a temporary adventure that might be overcome with amplification. classrooms that are too big can to a certain extent be made to feel smaller by the way that we amplify ourselves, and the greater distances that voices have to carry can be compensated to some extent by amplification. But the rooms will feel bigger to us in the way that our hearing apparatus has evolved to measure space around us. There's no getting around the fact that we are fewer people and in larger spaces. Our senses are telling us that, and that's difficult to overcome. And that's why I think that thinking too permanently about architecture in a time of fear, as you put it, might lead us to design spaces that we regret or that require renovation, you know, sort of redensifying as time wears on and the fear abates.
Mm, yeah, I could just see us now having a new category of architecture. Oh, that's a COVID design, right?
Yeah, easy enough to picture that.
You sure could.
And they would be characterized probably by spaces feeling way too big for the number of people that are gathering in them.
Yeah, and the austerity of surfaces, that will be the other hallmark of it all, right? So we're finding ourselves living in front of computers, walking around with iPhones and earbuds that are always in our heads, and we're wearing earphones on these calls, and it's extraordinary the assault on the ears that's occurred over the last few years as we become more and more into this isolated world of headphones and earbuds, trying to block out all ambient sound, but really maybe magnifying or over-magnifying sound coming into our ears. Do you see that as a longer-term engineering variable to large spaces when people maybe are having diminished hearing capacity just because of the way we've ruined ourselves? And does that play into the bigger picture of sound engineering within an auditorium or a classroom?
I mean, it's an interesting question. The way that we typically compensate for the hearing loss, you know, whether it's in conversation or in the, you know, an amplified setting, it's fairly legendary in rock and roll that the hearing of, you know, the operating engineers, the audio operating engineers, tends to degrade over time, and things get louder and louder and brighter as we compensate for our own hearing deficiencies. So it's easy to see things devolving into cacophony over time as society, you know, impairs itself more and more by abusing its hearing. I think there's another aspect that's concerning about how we regard our hearing now, and that is the social isolation and the environmental isolation that we cause ourselves by trying to drown out or at least supersede what's going on in the environment around us with what we're choosing to hear by putting it directly into our ears. Our hearing evolved as a means of keeping track of things around us that we can't see. It's hemispherical in its coverage, or spherical if you happen to be up in a tree, I suppose. We're very good at localizing sound based on its arrival at each one of our two ears and placing things in space. It's possible to close one's eyes and point to within a degree or two of the source of sound with our eyes closed. Our hearing is so accurate.
Mm. Yeah, it is all about awareness, isn't it?
It is. You know, whether it's out in the woods trying to avoid being eaten, you know, in an evolutionary sense, or trying not to be hit by a bus down here in the loop, it's important to hear what's going on around you. And drowning it out is arguably setting up a cognitive dissonance between what we see and what we hear that makes the brain work a lot harder than it needs to and may leave us without critical information.
Sound and the brain. Talk to me a bit about some of the science that works here with the way that the brain responds to sound. This is an area that most of us would not know anything about.
Well, our hearing evolved outdoors in complex environments that didn't really have any boundaries, no walls, no roof. And it evolved to keep track of events that we couldn't see. Our vision is very directional. Most mammals are. And there's a world out there behind us, for example, that our eyes are not necessarily pointed at. And it's important to keep track of things back there just in an evolutionary sense. And so our hearing got to be very, very good at tracking minute sounds and placing them in space in these very complex, diffuse outdoor environments. That's a basic physiology of our hearing. contrast that with the way our culture developed, at least Western culture and its art and education traditions, those are mostly indoor experiences and they're bounded by architecture, by enclosed spaces. And the sounds of voices and musical instruments, we expect to sound the way they do with walls around them because that's how we learn to hear them. So there's a duality in how our hearing physiology comes into play and our cultural expectations come into play. In performance spaces, we navigate that duality to achieve a balance, a fairly intricate one between the sense of enclosure and the sense of boundarylessness. And that's sort of right at the core of what we do as acousticians. More commonplace spaces, interiors, really need to acknowledge that complexity. Modern interiors tend to emphasize the enclosure part, and they rarely recognize the complexity part. To our ears, most of the modern spaces that are made of plaster and glass and stone and steel are simplistic, and they cause clatter and hold noise in that causes our sort of primordial physiology to go into an alarm state, because we can't hear the subtleties that that might be survival sounds in the wild. And so we are perennially left with a fight or flight mechanism triggered and higher levels of cortisol and adrenaline that add to prolonged stress. And we know all of the cognitive and wellness hazards of stress in the environment. And so we need to be aware that's what we're doing when we make simple interiors and ignore the hearing physiology that is always alert and always in action. You know, we think about the importance of COVID to our current architectural thought. And if we are designing interiors that stress us out, that keep us in a low-grade fight or flight mode physiologically for long periods of time, that we are, in fact, creating conditions that make us more susceptible to disease, whether it's COVID or anything else. And so I do think it's incumbent upon us as designers to think about that, to think about how our buildings sound, as well as how they look and how they interact with us on other physical levels.
I was reading an article last night about the dramatic drop in sound levels, I guess we'd call those decibels or something, around the world since COVID-19 started because of humans not flying, taking mass transit, cars driving, all the noise of being human, right? And as we're not moving so much, there's been this just dramatic lowering of sound in the world. I hadn't even thought about it, to tell you the truth. The other data point that it brought up was that you have a few billion people in a sedentary context, not moving as much, and the vibration of the earth has dropped dramatically. I mean, who would think, right? But humans moving by the billions are causing the crust of the earth to actually vibrate. And believe it or not, there's actually NASA satellites that measure the volume of vibration coming from the earth's surface and how they had noticed this dramatic drop in both sound and in vibration.
Yeah, it's interesting. The advent of that was very sudden as the initial fear set in and we all went home, and it's tailing off. You can feel it in the neighborhood. You can feel it in the cities. Presumably, you can measure it from the satellite as we gradually get used to this situation and try to get on with our lives for better or worse. And it's very easy, I think, in that gradual resumption of activity to forget what it was that we learned, you know, the calming effect of the loss of all of that activity. Again, for better or worse, it was a two-edged sword, but there was something really magical in it from a sensory standpoint.
I, as you know, travel quite a bit, and I have the privilege of being in so many architectural firms, as well as just hundreds of their projects around the world. And I have to ask, how often do architects intentionally and meaningfully consider sound engineering in the work that they do, and I'm talking sans a concert hall or a public venue where there's going to be concerts or performances, but in the, I'll call it the day-to-day design of hospitals and classrooms and universities and hospitality venues, et cetera, how often is this an intentional engineered design solution versus giving a head nod to it?
I mean, it's an interesting question because there's on one level, the sustainability certification and rating systems that have come onto the scene, you know, starting with LEED and going on from there, have certainly increased the awareness of sound in the built environment as we as acousticians perceive it. You know, perceiving their perceptions. Very often, it's a form-filling kind of approach. You know, what is the minimum that we need to do to get that LEED certification? And often we will find, and it's very often on projects with more resources, with higher budgets or more concentrated resources. You know, how is it that we can improve the environment for in response to our physiology, in the way that that I was describing before, in the complex environment, I think that there's a certain relaxation that we can do on a subconscious level that isn't possible in a more simplistic environment. You know, there are all sorts of opportunities with digital fabrication, with 3D printing that maybe has not yet come into its own, to explore complexity in the built environment, you know, that are more synonymous with the ornament that we saw in architecture 100 years ago and more. That ornament actually led to complexity or contributed complexity that made buildings of the Victorian age and earlier more sympathetic to our physiology, to our hearing physiology than modernism. There is a, you know, an analogy that we use, but we do a visualization of how sound behaves in the Farnsworth House, and everybody's mental image of that building is, you know, you're standing in the kitchen or the bedroom, and you're looking through that almost imperceptible wall of glass at all the nature beyond, and by the photograph, you feel very much in touch with the nature beyond the boundary of the house, but that's through your eyes, and that's through the lens of the camera. When you think about what your ears are seeing, they're seeing flat plaster ceiling that's 8.5 feet off the floor, 9 feet off the floor, and a travertine floor. And that wall of glass that's virtually invisible visually is a mirror, a perfect mirror acoustically, as are all of those beautiful and simple and unadorned wood veneered surfaces. And what we're really seeing with our ears in that space is a hall of mirrors. And it is so fundamentally opposed to the visual connection with nature, the complete separation from nature of the hearing environment, the aural environment, that it truly sets up a cognitive dissonance. We have to work to reconcile what we're seeing with what we're hearing. And I think, you know, I've been in this business for 25 years and been an architect for even longer than that. And, you know, I've seen interior after interior after interior that are made up of flat, hard surfaces that don't demonstrate necessarily that we've learned very much as a profession about how people's brains work.
Absolutely. That's why I ask, is there any context where we shouldn't be intentionally considering the acoustical design? Is there? So I say that because I see all these taglines on different architectural firms, and the operative is human experience. That seems to be the term everyone has gotten into the last few years, is we design for human experience, we enhance human experience, we optimize human experience, we do something with human experience. Are we not listening, no pun intended, to the idea of human experience being so, if not equal to the eyes, that we're not listening appropriately to the whole design? And it's one of the things I appreciated about the early writings of Ove Arup, who really believed in this thing called total design. I'm sure you're familiar with that. And it was this complete, not only visceral experience for the human, but on how we would look from a transdisciplinary way at design as well. So it was not one-dimensional. It went out multiple dimensions in its expression. And I'm wondering, why are we not more cognizant of this thing? Are we just obsessed with our eyes and not our ears?
Several responses come to mind. One, categorically, if you're designing spaces for people, you know, all of the senses should be considered. I mean, we can't turn any of them off. We can put in earplugs, I suppose, but they're all active and they all play a role in our health, our well-being, our cognitive performance, maybe our emotional performance as well. You know, we tend to think of every single space that's intended for human occupancy as a venue, you know, for someone with a message and to pass that message along to someone who wants to hear it. And it might be a concert hall, it might be a theater, it might be a lecture room, it might be a living room or a dining room. In a certain sense, we're all delivering messages to each other. We're all performing for each other in one way or another. We're all telling our stories. And it feels like we should be designing spaces that are conducive to that and that recognize our physiology. In addition to the serenity that we're trying to introduce architecturally, visually, in a space, the simplicity and serenity that we're trying to introduce should be matched by equal attention to the complexity that I think we're seeking on a subconscious level, acoustically and orally. So it's, yes, it is categorically worth thinking about in every space that we design. You know, name an outdoor environment that has a ceiling. It's hard to think of one. I don't think we encountered ceilings until we entered caves. And so every space that has a lid on it is—it's extreme to call it a violation of the environments that our hearing evolved in. But it's certainly a very different containing characteristic than the spaces than the environments in which our hearing evolved. We've joked amongst ourselves about how much better the world would be if there was a 1-year moratorium on drywall ceilings. Which are generally regarded as the cheapest to buy, but they're also the most antithetical to how we hear.
Yeah.
You know, thinking of the office spaces and the lobby space, you know, the social spaces, the restaurants that are so hard to hear in. Generally speaking, if you're having a hard time hearing what's going on, if things are just too overwhelming, look up and you're likely to see drywall up there. You know, an absorptive ceiling, by comparison, is one that is at least approaching the idea of the absorptiveness of no ceiling at all. You know, the complete loss of upward bound energy by not having a lid on the environment is actually better emulated by a soft ceiling than by anything else. You know, whether it's wood or drywall or plaster, generally speaking, you can make life better for your inhabitants just by making a ceiling absorptive.
Isn't that amazing?
And there are lots of exceptions to that rule in terms of carrying a voice through a larger space. But generally, if din is a problem, look up and deal with it up there first. That will make the most difference.
So we ask this of most of our guests, and that is, as an architect of, I will say, at least 3 decades, is there a building that's not one of your projects? It is something when in your youth, perhaps, that you saw and you went, oh my gosh, I want to be an architect. Look at that building. Is there something that you remember that inspired you to want to be an architect in the early days?
Interesting. It was a neighbor's house. I was, 7 years old, and I was not at a particularly happy point in my childhood, having just relocated and left behind everyone I knew. And there was a house going up. Some friends of my parents were building one, and it was more the construction site and the utter fascination of all the things that happened on a job site where a house was being built that was just utterly captivating. And it was fortunate that the guys, and they were all guys, who were doing the work you know, sort of took me on as a mascot almost. And I could pound nails and trowel concrete and wrestle masonry, you know, around the job site. And they loved it that I was there, and I loved it that they were letting me do it. And it was actually that, the participation in construction that set me on a course, I think. I mean, I can trace my entire professional life back to that moment.
What a great memory that is. Fantastic. Carl, thank you so much for joining me today. It has just been a pleasure to talk to you and to explore this area that doesn't get enough attention. And I want to thank you for being with me.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, Dave. Thanks so much for the opportunity.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of This Is Design Intelligence, sponsored by the Tricord Group and VIM. The producer for This Is Design Intelligence is Laura Spells. Sound engineering by Jared Knabel. This has been a DI Media Group production.